Welcome to Outspoken, where we dive deep into the topics and intersection of technology, money, business, and passion. I'm your host, Shayna Cosgrove.
I try to help people that can't help themselves or can't fully help themselves. Why do firemen run into burning buildings, right? Why do soldiers go stand out on patrol in really terrible places? They are helping people that can't help themselves. And so I look at ways to help our area. Most people are smart enough to recognize what needs to be done. And it really then just comes out to grinding it out, right? You know, and for some people, it's going to be easy. And sometimes you're just going to have to grind it out. When you're living it, you don't necessarily think about it. And then over time, I got to prepare, if you will, a little bit. And I realized in hindsight that, you know, how truly lucky I was doing great mission things and doing great technology things.
I am here today with Brian Cosgrove, who just happens to be NYLA's Chief Information Officer, Chief Financial Officer, and my husband, father to my two children. And anything else I should add, Brian?
I just approved a dog purchase.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. That was big doings. Today, we are just going to focus on you and learn all about you. So people know a bit about me, but you've been relatively silent on social media. Good about texting, but silent on social. So tell me a little bit about yourself and where you are today professionally.
Sure. So I think I have a couple of jobs. You rattled off the first two for NYLA. That's my primary activity, helping the business be successful, helping our people get to where, you know, they're trying to grow to. And then I also do contract work. So I have a U.S. government customer. I provide cybersecurity threat knowledge sharing. We help build the architectures that help the government do all the things that we want them to do.
Describe what it means to be a chief information officer.
There's kind of two major tasks that I see. I help our chief information security officer and our CEO to understand what are the risks associated with the data that we have, and also the mechanisms by which we are implementing kind of an end-to-end protection of all the information that we have in the company. That's both things like company proprietary information associated with how we do proposals, employee data that you have to keep safe. And then also we are stewards of the government's data in certain cases related to our contract activities and our work that we do as consultants.
What's your favorite part about your job?
Oh my gosh. Oh, my favorite part about my job is
flattery gets
is definitely
everywhere.
meetings with the CEO. That's my favorite. That's a good answer. All joking aside, that is one of my favorite aspects about the job. Mild aside, I spent over 20 years as a government civilian. And then in the background, after you started the company, I was working as the finance guy and a few other things. I really enjoy now that I am in the company, as of just over 3 years ago now, being able to take part in all the activities where we go in and talk to our customers and help them. Like I use that base of knowledge to help them understand in their language all the great things that NYLA can do for them as a customer. You know, I'm excited about NYLA. I think we have an awesome collection of people, and I love the opportunity of applying awesome people to really tough problems. And so I would say that's my favorite thing about the job.
What's your least favorite thing about the job?
Well, there is a CEO that I have to answer to. And I think the least favorite thing about the job is probably sometimes there's a decent amount of grind. I have a pretty high threshold for pain, for working and all that stuff and the amount of time. But over time, when you throw in crazy stuff like pandemics and making sure that we're doing all the right things to meet payroll on time and the day in and day out of the things that have to be done both tactically and also longer term activities, you have to be careful to not let it pull you away from the things that are most important to you, and that is self-care and caring for the folks that you surround yourselves with.
Let's start at the beginning. I mean, let's understand, where did you grow up? What did your parents do? for a living?
Oh, sure.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. So I grew up in a medium-sized city in Ohio, Akron. My folks were great, came from a really loving family. They were pretty humble in their, you know, work roles and all that stuff. My mom worked for the police department, and my dad, he actually had several jobs over his career, but he ended his career working for Lowe's. So he was kind of one of the mid-level, low-level managers in the Lowe's store in our area.
And he started his career as an entrepreneur, right?
That's right. In the 70s, he had a very successful landscaping business. He had served in Vietnam, had some pretty not fun things that he had, you know, was called on to take part in, but served his country well, came back, took advantage of the GI Bill that they had, and he got a few college classes under his belt, but decided it was more advantageous for him to go out with a buddy, and they started a landscaping business, and they probably had a good 5 or 6 years where they really had a good thriving business. And then I'm not sure how many people remember, but there was a pretty bad downturn in the late 70s. There was a really, really high inflation, and a lot of bad things were happening socially. The net result was that my dad's buddy wanted to sell out of his part of the business, and nobody would loan my dad enough money to buy that at a 22% interest rate or a 19%, you know, something crazy. And unfortunately, my parents were splitting at the time, and back then that was another kind of kiss of death. So the business folded. And so he ended up, unfortunately, bouncing around to a couple different careers after that. And it took him probably the better part of a decade to find something that, you know, that he could kind of make a career, if you will, out of that.
You ended up doing some lawn care work, though, with your dad.
That's right. He made enough money through his main job to kind of pay the bills, but there wasn't a lot left over for sort of luxuries. And so he always made sure that he had two or three large homes that he took care of on the side. And as I got older, I started actually mowing lawns on my own as a 9-year-old for kind of the same reasons where I'm like, hey, I sort of want to have some money to go to the movies or do whatever.
How did you get these jobs yourself? Like, did you do flyers? Tell me about how you did your sales.
So it was a force of personality. I think my grandfather, he and my grandmother lived a block away from the school that I went to. School was kindergarten to eighth grade, so we were over there kind of like our whole growing up. He was fantastically meticulous at caring for his yard, but he was also very gabby. He would chat up the neighbors and go figure, right? Shane is laughing right now because she knows that I actually must have gotten that gene from him. He could start up a conversation with anybody. Back then, I took advantage of his chattiness to pick up the mower and start pushing it. And I would mow the devil strip, the little slab of grass between the sidewalk and the street. Of course, then he would realize what I was doing after a little while. And at first he would yell and told me not to, you know, cut my foot off and all that stuff. But over time he started to help. So people would see me out there and
they like slow down the car.
They would kind of slow down. Well, and it was the best part like, about being in a tight knit neighborhood. Everybody knew kind of everybody else. And so they said, hey, well, why don't you go ask Mrs. So-and-so if she needs somebody to mow her yard?
So describe for us a little bit about your family life in Akron, because I grew up with my parents were the only family we knew in Pittsburgh, but you were lucky to be surrounded completely by your family.
Actually, I had a fantastic family. My
still
folks,
do.
And I still do, that's right. It's only gotten better. We were lucky enough to have most of the core family kind of in and around the Akron area. My mom and dad split up marriage-wise when I was about 4 and a half, but my family was super cool about it. They kind of allowed my mom to come over and bring us over to things that were on my dad's side of the family, you know, activities like weddings and the summer barbecues and things like that. And then vice versa, my mom always made sure that we invited everybody that was on my dad's side of the family to things that we would host at our house, like birthday parties or, you know, graduations and things like that. My mom had 4 brothers and sisters, and my dad had 3 brothers and sisters, but we knew our second cousins and their kids and that sort of stuff. So there was a great moment when a bit of sadness where we had a death in the family, our son William. I took him to the funeral, and I had told him on the drive there that there was going to be a ton of family. He had a ton of cousins, and we literally showed up at the showing where the evening before the funeral. and there's probably 40, 50 people. And he asked, well, Daddy, you know, where are all my cousins? And all I had to do was kind of wave my hand at the whole crowd. And his eyes bugged out. Like he just couldn't believe that he had that many aunts and uncles and cousins. And it was great. And it's like, so it was a really loving environment. And they really didn't care what I did, what my aspirations were early on. And I'm embarrassed to say this. I wanted to be a garbage man. And I thought that was the best thing in the world, being able to throw stuff into the back of that truck and then run the lever and crush stuff. That seemed like the coolest job in the world to like an 8-year-old kid.
Did you ever get to do a ride along?
They let me throw some stuff in a couple of times, but no ride alongs. But anyway, from the time that I wanted to be a garbage man to the time that I wanted to be an astronaut to the time I ended up being an engineer, the family was just like, just keep studying, keep working hard. We love you. You're going to do great. And that was really the ongoing message that kind of allowed me to go through.
When did you decide that you were going to be an electrical engineer?
It was somewhere right around the end of my junior year of high school or the very beginning of my senior year. I had a really fantastic pair of teachers, a woman who was a math ace, and she had a very well-paying job, decided that she wanted to kind of get out of the corporate rat race and became a math teacher. She had given us this focus. She had a way to kind of impart to you all of your geometric and trigonometric identities and things like that in a way that just kind of allowed it to kind of sink into your head. The other teacher was a guy who taught my, an elective that I took my junior year, and he was my physics teacher my senior year. He was a retired nuclear submarine captain, and he had this awesome picture of what looked like an old attack sub popped up through the Arctic ice, and people just kind of chilling out on the ice and all that stuff. And I always thought that was the coolest thing. And his whole approach to teaching physics was awesome. And it really kind of got me interested in things that were physics related. The elective was actually called electricity and electronics. That sort of got me heading down that path. And I started my freshman year of undergrad, checked that box. And I told myself, I'm going to try this. I don't know what it's going to be like, but let me try electrical engineering. And I just kept going. I loved it.
So you had declared electrical before you even went off to college?
Well, when I signed up, I was accepted in the honors program. I basically had the test scores to kind of get into fairly selective colleges, but I was, you know, from humble origins, right? So the idea of landing a $15,000 or $20,000 a year tuition sounded like this monumental, like it just felt like this mountain of money that I'm like, how would I ever come up with that? And what if I don't like it? It was actually frightening. And my folks loved me very much, but they helped me pay for high school. But there's a big difference between, you know, $1,500 or $2,000 a year for high school compared to $20,000 a year. You know, that was so far beyond their means. I picked the university that was very close to us, and it turned out to be actually a great choice. I had almost no debt coming out of college.
How did you pay for college?
I worked.
How many jobs?
two to three jobs, sometimes a little more than that.
What were the jobs?
I love movies, so I thought, hey, this seems like a great idea. I went to the movie theater and I got hired there for the whopping sum of $4.25 an hour.
Did you get to watch the movies for free?
I got to watch all the movies I wanted. And I also worked for a carpenter. So my best friend from 7, 8 years old, his dad was a carpenter, and somebody quit on him, and he was like kind of grumping about it while I was over there. And I said, well, I'll work for you I'll finish out the job with you if you want. And he was looking at me kind of like, I don't know if I need this skinny kid to, you know, like kind of get in the way. But as soon as he saw me work, he was like, loved it. So within the space of the 2 weeks that we finished out that job, he was like, well, I'm looking for somebody for next summer. Let me know if you're interested. And I was like, I'm interested.
Is that what you did all through college?
Yeah, I ended up working for the theater. And that ended when I started my internship coming out here to Maryland. I landed an internship with the government customer that I ended up going to work for a long time. And once I did that, I made enough that I was able to...
How much did they pay you an hour?
Oh, I don't even remember I think the opening salary was something like the equivalent of $18,000 a year, right? Which again, sounds ridiculously small right now, but back then—
Compared to $4.25 an hour.
Better than $4.25 by a lot, that's right. So I was able to actually pay for all the things that I had to take care of for both school and my car and insurance.
So it helped pay for college.
Oh yeah, 100%. So, and now, I mean, it didn't pay for college 100%, but it certainly covered my, it allowed me to not have to go back to the theater after. And so I enjoyed working for the carpenter, and it was, you know, that was much more like, he actually paid me much better. So by the time I was done with undergrad, I was probably making $9.50 or $10 an hour or something like that. But the combination of those two things, you know, I would do every other semester starting my junior year as an intern, and then I would come back home, and then I would work for that guy.
So you have a pretty interesting story about how you happened to get your co-op with the government. So can you tell us?
So Bill Clinton was president, and there was a lot of wrangling with Congress about, you know, who gets to spend what on whatever programs and things like that. And they ended up going into a deadlock to put the government into a furlough, a shutdown. And so got selected, and two other guys that I, you know, ended up getting to know very well were also part of that team. So there were three of us. We're going through the process together, and I had a, I don't know, like a 3.6 something GPA. And the one guy had a 3.997, you know, the guy had a 3.8 something, you know, again, sharp guy. And I, you know, still know both these dudes today. So really top-notch engineers. We go through the whole process. We make it through the polygraph, and we make it through all of the waiting. And then we're supposed to get informed of when our start date is exactly sometime in, you know, around Thanksgiving. Fast forward, the furlough happens, we don't hear it. And we weren't really tracking that because, you know, you're doing engineering class and two or three jobs at a time. And I'm like, I could really care less about what Congress is or isn't doing right now. Did not realize the direct impact that it was having. And the punchline that you're talking about was, because of all that financial wrangling, they were only going to take two people instead of three. We were pestering our co-op administrator to please let us know, please, you know, please ask, please ask. So finally, she picks up the phone and calls Maryland and talks to the lead co-op person, you know, for the government agency. And she says, you know what? I just got off the phone. We're only going to take two of your guys, you know, and they're going by GPA just because. But I just got off the phone with this other school, and the guy got tired of waiting. So since I got you here and we have such a long relationship, I'll give you the spot. And I'm listening literally as they have this back and forth. And I'm like, all of a sudden, I'm, you know, hopes dashed. And then all of a sudden, you know, through the roof elated. It was quite a crazy time.
When you were about to graduate, did you just naturally assume you were going to go work for the government? How did that happen? Did you interview with a bunch of jobs and then decide on the government?
I did. I ended up interviewing just because, you know, you're like, oh, well, I kind of owe it to myself to try and see what else is out there. I kind of had seen a little bit of the companies in the area where I was from. So like if I wanted to make ATM machines, I could go work for Diebold, and that just didn't seem that very interesting to me. I know a guy that co-opted the Cleveland Sewer Department, and making poop pumps move stuff around did not seem very cool. So checked out a place out in Indiana that was a Naval Surface Warfare Center. And I'm thinking, you know, this is like the middle of nowhere. And I was, you know, just so far gone from what I was at all interested in. Interviewed with a place called Battelle in Columbus, stuff like that.
Going back to college, how did you even study? You had like three jobs and you were biking to school. Did you like, no, and did you even own a computer at the time?
No, like, I did not own a computer. I did have a car though. I had my priorities, right? So no, thankfully the university had computer labs available, so we could do that. And then as we got further into school, you basically had homework buddies. So I would use my buddy's computers because if we had a lab, we would work on it together, but we could do that.
So did you ever try to switch out of electrical engineering?
No.
So you were in from the get-go.
In from the get-go. I had a crisis of confidence. At one point, I had a guy who looked like Dilbert, and I'm pretty sure he was around when the transistor was invented. He was one of the weed out classes. I had a really terrible time with him and a really terrible time in my first electromagnetics class. And I was thinking, oh my God, I'm one of the dudes that's getting weeded out. And then there were many people that actually had a terrible time with this electromagnetics professor. As it turns out, he was writing a textbook. And so instead of having a book and a well-formed curriculum, he was actually using us as guinea pigs to write his textbook, which, hey, you know, whatever, that's his prerogative. I kind of take it for what it was. I started my first co-op tour after that, And so I had this amazing four and a half months of...
So your experience on the job.
Oh my gosh, it was such a refreshing. I had so much fun. We actually built a power supply for the Marine Corps. I had this Navy lieutenant, perfect guy at the perfect time. He was just irreverent and just kind of like didn't care enough to say, hey, you know what? That we have a contract with a big company that's supposed to be building this thing for us. But, you know, for the space of like $1,500, we could probably buy most of the parts that we need. He did some research and I helped him put it all together. We did all the circuit design. He had me doing the calculations to make sure that the like all of the right voltages and currents were accounted for and things like that. We put in things that allowed you to basically have an uninterruptible power supply. So that means you could have like line power coming from the wall or from a vehicle or from batteries, and it would not miss. The funny slash sad part was the big contractor actually shocked at least three poor Marines with their first couple of designs because it was not grounded correctly. So we came in with the design. We actually cheated a little bit. We used the model shop at the agency that we work for. They milled us a big block of aluminum into a beautiful lightweight. So we basically had a power supply that put out twice the power and a third of the weight. And that was a big deal. So anyway, great experience. Got to go out to the Marine Corps training area in Camp Lejeune. Not a terribly luxurious place, but I learned a lot of great swear words, and I really actually had a great technical experience teaching the Marines how to use the systems that we put together. And that was both the radio side and also the power supply. So it was really fun.
So you graduated college in 1997?
1998.
Electrical engineering isn't known for a lot of women in engineering. Do you remember if there were any women in your classes?
I do. There were a handful. It was somewhere, I would say, in the 35 to 50 range of total students that you would see in your engineering classes. I think that there were probably six or seven women, maybe.
So 15%?
Yeah, something like that.
Do you remember your starting salary when you graduated?
I do. It was $43,000, I think.
Did you get a signing bonus?
I did. I got a great signing bonus of $5,000, and then I got free grad school for two semesters. Anytime I wanted to, I could start any, as long as it was an accredited university. So,
did you get a 401k match?
Yep, they match 401k, pretty standard stuff, 5% as long as you get 1% for free, and then, you know, dollar for dollar for the next four.
Did they give you moving expenses too?
I want to say yes, I think. So, yes.
What was your reaction to that salary?
Oh my gosh, it was like this amazing, like, oh, you know, the light shined down from heaven. I did. I felt incredibly rich. You know, I go from this crazy work schedule, school schedule, to now all of a sudden I have what I was considering a pretty fat paycheck. I still remember this feeling of like, I only have to work for 7 or 8 or 9 hours a day, you know, depending.
So did you find like lawns to mow as a side gig?
No, I did not actually.
So no side gigs ever, right? After college? Did you ever have a side gig?
Never had a paid job after that other than my,
was
main
it
government job.
Super weird to not have like a bazillion hours of work to do all day?
No, I mean, I used it to, I love living. And so I wanted to, part of the reason that I took the job that I did was because it allowed for travel and things like that. And so I had the opportunity to do a lot of fun things. There was a lot of surging activities, right? So you may end up working, you know, 50, 60 hours in a week, or you may be on a travel activity where you're traveling for a week or 3 weeks and you're doing crazy hours. And then when you come home, you have lots of leave to burn or a lot of extra cash. And so we would do a lot of weekend trips.
You started traveling all over.
Yeah.
Traveling every chance you could.
My job, yeah, exactly. My motto was anytime, anywhere. You know, Have bag, will travel. That's right.
And when did you start your master's degree? And what was that like? Did you go full time for your master's?
So I purposely wanted to wait. I knew my tastes were changing a little bit and I wanted to do something that was a little different than a heavy focus on electromagnetics, right? So something other than just radio waves and antennas. I love that stuff. It's a lot of fun. I still enjoy talking to William about it, our son, and I'll talk to Rose about it because we were, you know, we've already been talking a little bit about electricity. But I really had a desire to work for, I set a strict goal of like, I'm going to work 2 years. I'm going to get a little bit of life experience under my belt, and then I'm going to pick something to specialize in. During those 2 years, I kind of did the same sort of thing that I was talking about with travel. I would take kind of any job. You know, I covered the gamut from, well, I just got to work with a lot of interesting stuff and a lot of cool people. The net effect was it allowed me to pick that. So I used my master's degree. I did 2 classes after hours, you know, first. And then I used my special master's degree fellowship through the agency that I worked for. And it was great. I did 4 classes and 4 classes. And I was able to...
So you went full-time for a year?
I did, yeah. It was really cool.
While getting a full salary?
That was the best
part
about it.
Damn, that's pretty nice.
It was a very nice... That was the...
I had to slog away at night.
I feel for you. I feel for you. During the dot-com bubble, everybody who had any sort of engineering skills were heavily recruited by a lot of different people. And so in order to kind of be competitive, the federal government folks were incentivizing with stuff like that. So it was very fortunate. I probably got almost at the top of those incentivization plans because I got the $5,000 signing bonus. It was fantastic to be able to just get out and do the classwork and stuff like that. And I used it to kind of fill in the gaps, if you will, between I went to Johns Hopkins for my master's, and they had a fantastic pre-planned programs that you could do if you wanted to specialize in certain things. And I ended up sort of picking my own, and I don't like to not get what I want. So I talked to my advisors and I said, hey, you know, I don't really want to take the stochastic processes class again because I think I had my fill of you know, really terrible statistics when I was a senior. I still have my book for looking up these unsolvable, you know, triple integrals. Can I just like skip that? And he's like, well, it's, yeah, if you feel like you can make it, go for it. You know, it's like, and he reminded me of, you have to get a B or better to get the money reimbursed. And I was like, I'm on it. I'm good. So I ended up basically skipping that, and I went straight to like advanced laser design instead of the, you know, the first class, stuff like that. But it allowed me to do in those 10 classes all the things that I really wanted to kind of get and specialize in.
Now, when did you ever actually own a computer? Did you own a computer by the time you got your master's?
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Was it a tower? Was it a Gateway?
I
want to know the details.
I almost bought the Gateway, I think, back then. I don't know if, again, another history lesson for folks. There was this fantastic, they had the best advertising. They had cows
like
on their boxes.
Everything
looked like a cow box. So, but I bought a tower.
Was it expensive? Do you remember? Was it like horrifying to you to buy one?
No, at this point, by the time I realized what's that?
Did you buy a Dell?
I did not. I bought an HP.
You're a big HP fan though.
I ended up being an HP fan. I had an HP tower and then an HP laptop. And then they sold out to somebody, I think at Lenovo or something like that.
Yeah.
And I just, after that, I flipped and went to a different manufacturer. But over time, I landed on Apple. I like the fact that Apple, I can do
Linux.
You
mean over time, like over 25 years?
What's that?
When did you get your first Apple computer?
Well, I got my first Apple computer when my wife handed me down.
No,
her,
I made
her
you get first a phone.
That's true. You did. And you made me get rid of my awesome flip phone.
Yeah. One of the secrets about Brian is he's actually behind the technological curve. So if there's a midpoint of most curves, Brian's still back. He's slow to adopt, I would guess. He likes to see other people shake it out and buy it when it's really a commodity.
But I don't always look for the techno gadget to solve my problem.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your career progression up until Nyla.
I had a great career. I had an amazing array of people that I got to interact with on a professional level. And then over time, you become friends with a lot of these folks. And, you know, you get to share travel experiences, you get to share crazy work hour experiences and things like that. This weird combination of, you know, when you're scared to death or you're, you know, like super excited because you just nailed something really, really tough. That kind of stuff is really, really made a lot of rewarding experiences kind of just sown throughout my, you know, over 21 years, I guess, that I had. And then the career progression, you know, like I guess I never felt like I was, I knew that the government salaries, like, you know, I mean, you hear from a pretty directly. Like a lot of the big companies in the area will always try to not poach you exactly, but they definitely make it known that it's like, hey, you know, if you ever decided that you're tired of working for the government, you can come work for us and do similar work. And oh, by the way, you'll probably get paid a lot more. You know, that was probably true in the strict fiscal sense of what my paycheck would have said. But when you factor in all of the, I had a lot of pay incentives. I got overtime, several, you know, on many, many activities, other sorts of incentive pays because you're going into dangerous locations and stuff like that. And of course, it horrified my dad and my mom. But at the same time, I was like, hey, man, I'm loving it. You know, try to chill out. And then I would bring them home cool stuff. And so, you know, I got to live at a level of richness that I think that was not necessarily commensurate with my salary. But, you know, like all those extra opportunities allowed me to pay off my school debt. I was debt-free from college in, say, under 2 years, I think it was, or right at 2 years. I always paid my cars off early and things like that. So I was able to build my retirement savings. I was able to build regular savings and whatnot. So it was really, that combination of professional satisfaction and just, you know, being able to do cool stuff like buy a carpet, you know, that's made by the people down the street from where you're buying it from, right, is pretty awesome, as opposed to kind of going to the mall and picking out something that, you know, who knows.
But you love the work, right?
Oh, yeah. And that's why it never felt like work. It was just, I was always kind of overcome with this, like, wow, I cannot believe that somebody is paying me to do this stuff, because it really is so much fun. I got to learn, and the speed at which I learned was so dramatically higher than I would have gotten in most any other place that I've experienced since then, right? When I talk to people, they're like, oh, that's such, I'm envious. And I was like, wow, really? I'm like, oh, that's, you know, when you're living it, you don't necessarily think about it. And then over time, I got to compare, if you will, a little bit. And I realized in hindsight that, you know, how truly lucky I was to kind of, you lucked into the first group of people. And then I learned enough to then go search out other teams like that. So I had a really great career of being able to go from doing great mission things and doing great technology things.
Now, they have different GS levels. Where did you come in at?
I went back and looked.
When you were a co-op, what was it? Like a 6?
It was like a GS2 or 1 or 3 or something. Yeah, it was literally like the bottom of the barrel. By the time you get done, as long as you graduate with something reasonable, you get a GS9 when you started.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
what was your final GS before you left to join Nyla?
I was a GS15 for about 6 or 7 years for the last part of my career.
What would you say is your biggest professional success?
Outside of Nyla, you know, I think my biggest professional success, I really felt like I kind of like Tarzan from cool task to cool task. But the last thing that I did as a civilian, I was actually had the privilege of leading about 85 or 90 people. We had a small program that was given a task to do some really awesome cybersecurity work. We ended up building a really kick butt microservice architecture that it did things that just either weren't able to be done before, or automated things that had previously been manual tasks. And so that idea of being able to give back time to people so that they could actually use their skills instead of doing mundane shuffling of things from point A to point B or, you know, whatever, it was both fun from the challenge perspective, the technology perspective, and also seeing the outcome perspective. All that together really, really was very, very satisfying.
And it was high visibility, right?
Yeah. I mean, very high visibility. We had everybody kind of knew our program name, and everybody talked agile. A lot of people were talking DevOps, and you know, when we first started, they knew they wanted to do it, but they didn't have a budget. So we actually had to kind of help go. Tin cup is the phrase that I was using, where I'm like, hey, this is really going to be awesome. And these guys said that it really matters to them. So let's do this.
So like your days of mowing lawns.
Yeah, right.
Getting lawn mowing clients.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the skills that I have kind of innately is I can take a complex technical thing that we're trying to do and translate into why it matters for either mission people or for how it translates into the budget impacts, you know, things like that. So even though I wasn't like doing anything I didn't pick the budget, I didn't pick the contracts or anything like that, I still had the obligation to help them understand, you know, where and why we were doing the things that we were, to help them then make their choices. That confidence and that ability to translate to them allowed them to see the value in what we were doing, even though it was like, for a lot of the managers, it was a little bit scary because they were like, hey, wait, well, how can you tell me that you don't know exactly what you're going to be producing in you know, a month or 3 months or 6 months? And, you know, we kind of helped them understand that that's the, you know, that's the nature of what Agile is. And then there was a wonderful person who ended up becoming one of the technical leads when I left, that brought a DevOps, like a true DevOps activity to our operations posture. And again, it was like one of the few times that I've actually seen a DevOps activity implemented in the spaces well. And so, you know, we had it done across, you know, a bunch of different product teams across a couple of different contracts. And I think that it felt really good to be able to come up with not just the technical designs, convey that to the mission and the budget people to keep them happy and saying, yeah, man, you guys are doing the right stuff, but then also to keep hitting the milestones that they were looking for. And so like we were actually able to drive real activity with real humans. And that's always the hard part, right? When you go from like, hey, this is a great, you know, great stick figure on paper, but trying to make real people do that with, you know, with real deadlines and all the real problems that come up, it was very satisfying. And we were honored with an award from the ODNI. We came in 2.5 months ahead of schedule in about $1,500,000 budget. So it was really a great way to cap my you know, civilian time.
And on the other hand, tell me about a time that was probably your biggest failure professionally. And what did you learn from it, if anything?
Yeah. Wow. So the thing that just popped in my head, there was a task that I was part of. It was kind of me and another engineer. And we were doing kind of a detailed out with the military crew. And so we were really, from an equipment and a widget perspective, we only had what we kind of brought with us, right? There was no easy way to get anything. So you kind of had to be self-sufficient. And so we
MacGyver.
Were able to...
MacGyver-like?
Yeah.
did you have duct tape on you?
You would be surprised what I can do with duct tape and some random wire pieces. So, but the failure, we thought that we did as much as we could. We actually had two copies of the stack of equipment that we needed. And if any of my old friends hear this, they'll laugh, but I used to have tool bags with me, and my tool bags, the joke was there wasn't much that I couldn't come up with that, you know, like any issue I could come out of there from, you know, if we had to work DC to daylight, you know, like any technology, you know, we felt pretty good, about as good as you could do going out. We'd tested everything. Anyway, we get out on the road and something happened, something different in both stacks of the equipment. And then we actually had a different challenge on a radio wave activity that was different than that. So it was, you know, it was very interesting. We had these, you're out in the middle of nowhere and it's tough and terrible conditions. And you have all these other things that are going on around you. And then you have you realize that the systems that you put together are not actually performing, and you're trying to work through these bugs and it didn't work. And so after we were
neither
back,
neither stack worked. Neither one. So you had two copies.
So we had two copies. And so I had to, I actually had three different things that I could do that would be quote unquote successful. The first two would have been way more valuable. And the third was like, well, it's better than nothing, you know? And
did
so
you get to any of them?
Well, I got the third one. I did the better than nothing. Right. And so it was one of these things where we really wanted to do a lot more activity in the field. And the third thing allowed us to do activity, but it was all post, you know, after. So that was the part that was a little tough. But I felt terrible because, you know, we had gone to all this trouble. We had gone a bazillion miles from home, and we had a lot of people that were, you know, interested in what we were doing. And so I'd not had a true, like a terrible failure up to that point in the work sense. You know, I mean, you always bump your head along the way on any project. And I don't mind that, right? It's like, I always, you know, no matter how good or bad situations are going, there's always things you can learn from. But this was one of those where it's like, it always made me feel like, oh, as we got back to the real world and talking with other senior engineers, we discovered there were other things that we could have done. And that's the part that why it sticks in my, you know, sticks in my memory as a failure, because I did not have enough specific knowledge in a certain area of the technology stack that we were using. And that was the part that I then, you know, ended up trying to learn more, obviously, but you know, it was just an unfortunate series of events that really highlighted that lacking in our team.
Were you missing a part? What was the issue that you were missing a part, or you?
No,
didn't
we
have
had
the-
two completely independent hardware failures. It was a something basically broke loose or broke inside
in the travel?
Inside. Yeah, we thought we were covered because we had the double, the double
right.
stack, but we didn't account for the
both stacks.
Yeah, so.
Now, what would you say is your superpower?
Ooh.
I'm going to limit you to three. I feel like you're going to answer more than one.
Limit? Oh my gosh. No, I...
What would you say if I even limited you to three? What is your number one superpower, Brian?
My superpower is just being able to connect with people. Sort of like what I was describing before with my last civilian job. I think there's no problem that we can't tackle if we put our heads to it. And I love tackling hard problems. I think I have the ability to convey to people that energy. I either come up with or I work with people to come up with a vision on how to actually knock something out. And then I can tell people about it. It's like, here's how we're going to do it. And oh, by the way, here's where, you have to divide this out into, this group does this group does that, whatever. And oh yeah, we can kind of talk up the stack to, managers, and I don't care how high you want to go. We've certainly conveyed at the, national strategic level, here's what stuff is going to do for you. At the, kind of widget level, here's where widgets are going to come into play and why we're going to use, Elasticsearch over here, and we're going to use this other stuff over there, and blah, blah, blah. So
now, were communication skills always something you were strong at?
Oh my God, no. I used to be the most shy, like terribly shy.
I think that would surprise most people.
At one point during the middle of high school, I ended up at the prodding of a, I would say ex-girlfriend, but high school, it was like a, we quote
it's
unquote.
Okay, Brian.
Yeah. Sorry, this is a sore subject for my CEO wife boss. But anyway, wonderful woman. And I know her and her husband now, and they're wonderful. Yeah, they're great people.
Yeah. Go on.
She prodded me to go to this kind of weekend youth group retreat. And it kind of gave me a place to sort of just get away from everybody that I was at my school with and all that stuff, and really just sort of start again. And I realized something during that period that allowed me to start building on that and becoming better at just talking to people.
On the flip side of the coin, now, what would you say you struggle with professionally?
I struggle keeping up with Slack. I'm joking.
No, that's true. But
that is
that is facts. But what is a major struggle of yours professionally? Like something you're just not strong at?
I think that the biggest struggle I have is probably saying no to stuff. And this has been a learned skill for me where, again, it's that always being part of fast moving teams, and it's like something comes up. It's not like that it can't be done. It's just like, well, what do we, what heaven and earth do we have to move to make it happen? And then let's dig in, right? Grab the rope, start pulling the sled, whatever analogy you want to use. Earlier in my career, I said yes to everything, which can be good. I had a lot of great experiences, but it can also be bad because it doesn't allow you to focus on the most right things. There are many often good things to be done. So learning how to focus on the most right things has been a learned skill for me. I continue to struggle with that, but I've gotten a lot better at it and continuing to work.
Over your career, is there anything you wish you did differently? I took a turn there, but I wish I hadn't.
I think I'm actually happy to say that I really don't have any regrets like that. I do a lot of introspective thinking, and I don't generally I feel like I'm happy with who I am today, and I am the summation of all the things that I did before that. So the good, the bad, and the ugly, it wasn't always a bed of roses and, milk and honey flowing from the walls or whatever, but I don't know that I would do anything differently, except maybe, I would keep my shares of Cisco for a lot longer than I did that and eBay. My 1995, my college buddy recommended those two stocks, and they were both under $5. So if I had held that until 1999, 2000, I would probably have started with a much bigger pile of cash.
What's one common myth about your profession or field that you'd like to debunk?
I think that a lot of people think of engineers as Dilbert, right? Or the kid, you know, the pick your favorite nerdy character on a sitcom or something with a pocket protector and a lot of pens or whatever. And I think that there's so many aspects of engineering and electrical in particular that aren't just, can you do a math problem well? You know, are you like that kind of dorky kid that can recite, you know, Star Trek references ad nauseum, but that is fun and that's part of it. And I enjoy, you know, making dorky jokes. But I think that the ability to be able to apply both your technical savvy and also reach out and work in a team is, you know, that's probably the biggest misnomer. Not everybody looks like the, you know, the Dilbert character with a pocket protector.
What's one thing you wish you had known when you began your career?
Oh, well, I don't know if we have enough time to cover all that.
Oh, really?
For me, the thing that I wish I knew, I think back then, that I feel like I have an appreciation for now, is maybe knowing how to trust yourself. You know, like
that's probably mine too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always feel like I was actually thinking about one of my major failures, and it was always looking at others and thinking that they were the example that I needed to follow,
right,
or the mold, and not trusting myself enough.
Yeah. And I think that is exactly the feeling or the scenario that I think I had in mind saying that, where for me it was, I can intuitively see how, you know, say electromagnetics happen, right, at a very interesting granularity. Same with optics, and you know, I can do complex broad scope things well. I am a terrible, terrible brute force programmer. I've been able to work through and, you know, had a lot of help along the way, but kind of learned Unix shell scripting and Perl and Python. And I learned C, C++ in
it's
undergrad.
Because you didn't take piano as a kid.
I did not take piano as a kid. I should have. I got into it enough to like play around with it and become proficient, but it was always like brute force, right? And I didn't love it. And I think what I know now that I didn't know then was that it was okay to not love it, right? You didn't have to be like that other guy, you know, and hold yourself up to be some uber programmer or something like that. You know?
And what are the, you have like two or three expressions about trusting yourself. One's from Yoda.
Oh, already know you, that which you need, right? So yeah, you can study a problem to death, right? Paralysis by analysis, all that stuff. But it gets back to that, you know, most people are smart enough to recognize what needs to be done. And it really then just comes out to grinding it out, right? You know, and for some people, it's going to be easy. And sometimes you're just going to have to grind it out. And then, I don't know, I think maybe the other saying is just do what you say you're going to do. You know, the abilities that you possess, you know, like being able to do the things that you recognize what you're very good at compared to everybody else, and then focus on and contributing that to the, you know, the projects and the problems that you're solving is really, you know, like the key to effectiveness. But people won't trust you if you'd promise the world, or if you promise, you know, whatever, and you don't deliver. That only goes so far. So you have to do what you say you'll do.
What is your favorite time-saving hack? Do you have any things that you do that give you back time?
I try to actually, again, joking about the Slack. Slack is a great tool, very useful for a lot of things, but it also can become a distraction. What I do, my time hack is set out my, like I know that I'm most effective at doing things that require clean thought or innovative thought right after I wake up in the morning and kind of before the kids wake up, you know, so I have like this burst of creativity. And so I use that time to, if I, you know, everything from business processes that we're doing for Nyla or writing proposals, or if I'm just daydreaming about, like, you know, I've got this physics thing that I've been dreaming about and thinking about and occasionally writing down that someday will turn into a submission to a peer-reviewed journal and I'll probably end up with a gold medal. No, but all those things were, you know, knowing when you're most effective and when your brain's functioning well is probably that biggest hack, you know. And then going in and peppering in, you have to use the tools that you and your teams are using. So I'll go in and take care of the things that require that thought first. And then I'll take care of the things like email or reading the Slack channels and keeping those sort of asynchronous communication things going sort of whenever they can. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I do that where I'll work on those things and then I put that away and I get it out of my face and then I'll go back to doing things that I want to concentrate on. And that's how I'm most effective.
You know, I'm a pretty big reader. Nyla has its own book club. Tell me about your favorite book, and it doesn't have to be business related.
Oh.
And why?
The Autobiography of Ben Franklin is probably one of my favorite books. I've read it, I don't know, I mean, it's short. I've probably read it like a half a dozen times or something like that. I just love the character that comes out in the book. And, you know, then of course, some of the things that you've heard about, you know, obviously reading between the lines afterwards and stuff, but it's both enjoyable and also educational, like, or you know, gives you things to like, to sort of model yourself after, you know, to be sort of a free spirit, but still focused on being effective, you know? And I think that was really that magic that Ben Franklin struck, is not being afraid to be a little bit childlike and sort of meandering through and not afraid to find his way to something new, but also not being a dope, right? He's not like, oh, I'm just hanging out on the beach. You know, he actually had like his whole life seemed very purpose-driven. And I thought that was cool. The other, you could call it a business book. My wife actually prompted me to read a book a couple of years ago now called Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Yeah, at the time I felt myself to be fairly savvy with like personal finance. So I was like, oh, I don't know how much I need another personal finance, you know, how-to book or something like that. But I was so dramatically wrong. I even from reading the cover, I didn't recognize what it was about exactly. And then when I finally went back to it and really read the synopsis, I was like, okay, you know, and I think it gives so many life hacks. It gives you a lot of things to focus on how to be effective. That's portrayed as a being effective at business, but that can also be like your part as an executive in, you know, executing anything in either a business that you own or just being part of a bigger team and being a more productive and more effective person, doing that for your home life, your business life, you know, corporate, whatever.
That's a great lead in to the next question was, what do you think about when you think about money? And I know we've had a lot of discussions and arguments about money as most married couples over the year. But what does money like mean to you, or, you know, the pursuit of money? Do you use it as a measure of success, or what do you think about, you know?
My intent is to live richly and deeply, you know, and really that's rooted in people. And experiences, you know, like how do you bring yourself to interact with, you know, new people, or how do you interact with the people that you surround yourself with, you know, day in and day out, you know, both family, friends, and then, you know, any kind of, you know, one-offs. So I think that from that perspective, maybe easier or not with, you know, with money, but yeah, I think to me, it's really less about the total amount and more about the, you know, knowing, do you have enough to live the way that you want to? And for us, you know, for me, living richly and deeply, that means a lot of different things. And so as I set my goals, as I set my dreams, you know, and align that to, you know, how much money do I need to make that happen? How much, you know, I have philanthropic goals. So I look at it as a, you know, how do you give back? And so I think that to me is one of the areas where applying what I think are, you know, my problem solving abilities to say things that help the greater Baltimore area, the greater just kind of like bigger problems that are out there, you know, think local and act global.
Yeah. You know? Now, passion. You are, I would say, a pretty passionate man. What are the top three things you're the most passionate about and why?
Ooh, wow.
Like what? You know, what gets you out of bed? What keeps you going?
Oh, so I am actually very, I think very passionate about family and I'll say civic duty. The reason that I get up in the morning is because I want to have a fulfilling existence. And to me, that means being a positive impact as much as possible or practical, everybody that I interact with. You know, when I was a co-op or even before that, right, I used to joke and say, guaranteed this place is going to look better after I leave than when I got here, right? And, you know, like when I was a lawn guy, that meant what it meant, right? When I was an engineering co-op or, young engineer, I would do things like label cables because it saved me time.
Because you're passionate about cleanliness.
Yeah, you know. Well, but it was more
about
than
order.
It was less about like, you know, meticulous symmetry. Ordering, but more about like, how do you, you know, it's like, hey, if I do this, nobody else wants to do it, and it actually will save everybody time, you know. So everybody had a much easier time finding the appropriate cable they were looking for when I had applied my labels. So, but I love the idea of giving back, and I think that I use a phrase with our kids now. I try to help people that can't help themselves or can't fully help themselves. Why do firemen run into burning buildings, right? Why do soldiers go stand out on patrol in really terrible places? They are helping people that can't help themselves. And so I look at ways to help our area.
What advice do you have for young people today?
Well, that's a great question. I think that for young people, I would say one of the best things that you can do is, you know, learn yourself and then also dream big, right? So don't be afraid to dream like these dreams that seem incredibly just way, way far out, right? It's like, think about the best, most cool thing that you want to do and go get it. And it's not that you can't do it. It's, you know, what are the things that you have to do to get there, right? And you can deconstruct that into a series of activities that, you know, sometimes the activities may take a month, sometimes they may take 27 years, you know, but you'll, but you can get there if you really, really want it.
So anything is possible.
Anything's possible.
Tell me something about yourself that might surprise others.
I am a fourth degree black belt in Japanese martial art.
And you also were a varsity bowler in college.
thank you for bringing that up.
Tell us the team name, please.
You know, actually, I don't remember the team
Zips.
Name. Oh, well, okay, it was the Zips, sure. But the University of Akron had a bowling team. The guy... So at the time, I grew up bowling.
So don't let him shake you down at a bowling game.
I loved it, man. I loved it. I loved to bowl. I haven't bowled anything close to regularly in probably a decade now. But I at the time, I loved it. I grew up bowling. And to me, again, you know, not having a lot of cash, the bowling alley was in the basement of the student, like the place where you could go get lunch, basically. And so I usually had about 45 minutes.
That explains everything.
Yeah. So I would roll in, I'd grab like a couple cheap slices of pizza and a Pepsi, and then I would go into the basement and I would bowl, you know, for 15, 20 minutes, whatever.
Did they only sell Pepsi in Ohio?
Like, no, they sell what's the family? Most major soft drinks there, and they call it pop.
Right.
But my dad was a Pepsi guy, and so we were a Pepsi family. We knew Coke and Pepsi very distinctly had different flavors, and because we grew up.
I'm a strong Coke girl.
Yeah, you know, Diet Coke. Will not hold that against you.
That was in my past. So tell me, what does the future look like for you? What are some of your next steps?
I actually, this morning, I just, one of the things, mental exercises, if you will, that I'm working on is my future self picture. So trying to like, you know, list out a very specific image of myself, you know, kind of in written words at 3 years out and 5 years out. And as I get through that, then I'm going to do one that's more like, you know, when I'm 60 and, you know, stuff like that. But according to that, I am going to, I've got a couple cool things in the works, but basically it's really digging in on the Nyla activity. And yeah, I think we actually have a really cool thing that we've begun. It's been growing well. The people that we have on the team are fantastic. And it's really cool to kind of be part of that. It's very humbling and very invigorating at the same time, right? So like I see us really kind of doubling, you know, my efforts on that over the coming couple of years, where I am currently on contract doing consulting pretty much full time, but gradually pulling back and really concentrating on making the business fly as much as I can, you know, as part of that team with you as my CEO boss.
In separate offices.
In separate offices, that's right. But also the rest of the executives, you know, crew that we have and the rest of the staff that are supporting the, you know, the folks that we have on contract are really awesome. That to me is a different type of fun. It's certainly not like the same as doing crazy, you know, crazy photonic stuff, but I really enjoy that.
Well, Brian, I want to thank you so much, and I'm going to corner you again another time so we can talk more about your time at Nyla. And I think a lot of people want to know about what's it like to work with your wife. And
Hashtag awesome. That's all I got to say.
Okay, I'm recording now.
Oh, you are?
Oh, wait, let me turn.
Did you skip my burp?
Doesn't matter. Okay, don't burp during the thing, okay?
I will not.
Did he feed you too?
He did sometimes, but most of the time
critical for you. All right, so you bought a desktop. Sorry, we keep getting interrupted by our daughter.
Yeah.
She's yelling at Alexa and then our son. 6 or 7 months.
No, 6 or 7 years.
You were a GS15. You got the promotion during our wedding.
No.
Yes, you did. Okay, so we were interrupted by my daughter who has been yelling at Alexa. And Brian and I were also arguing about the exact timeline of things. Turns out Brian was right.
Woohoo!
Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. Please be sure to share it with friends and family. If you'd like to follow us on social media, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn under the Outspoken Podcast. Thanks again, and chin up, heads up, eyes forward.